Is this the preamble? What are we talking about?
No, we need to do preamble. You don't even have to do a goddamn preamble.
We have a house style and we have to stick to it. You know.
Oh, God.
Are you but having you know your... what?
What? Just, oh, God. I'd love to know what internal monologue went on there to elicit a, oh, God.
The oh, God is... Is this the preamble or not? We need to get straight to the theme tune.
Oh, God. Okay, hang on. I've got to make it happen. Boom.
The best bits. I'll use small words so that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
You are stupid. You have no taste, a lousy sense of humor, and you smell.
Don't call me stupid.
Don't call me stupid.
There we go. Hello and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where we pick our favourite scenes from randomly selected. I said randomly selected.
Don't call me stupid.
I always find that the later we record, the more gummy my mouth is. And we are recording late tonight. Yeah, that's what happens. I'm slurring. I slur, and it might also be the three Jack Daniels I had before we came. Well, anyway, it's me. I'm your co-host, Will, writer of three films plus the Star Wars. And I am joined once again by my co-host and writer of one and a bit films and three and a bit episodes of TV.
Do you have to keep reminding people of that every fucking episode?
Kevin.
This is why I do my little goofy intros, is because I skip over. I have to tell people I've done one film instead of three.
Jesus Christ.
I don't even see. I just see the words and I say, right, I just have to get these out and that will get us onto the next stage. And we're at it. We're on the next stage.
We're at it. Sopranos. That was a really good ambiguous ending to a season.
No spoiler, because I haven't seen the end of Sopranos. And I want to.
Well, it's ambiguous the way that it ends.
All I know about the ending of The Sopranos...
We don't know whether Tony gets his pizza or not.
Okay. All I know is that people were really cross about it, the end of Sopranos. Well, am I right?
They're wrong. I think we don't talk about TV on this thing. We do that on our Patreon podcast.
Yeah.
But that is a fantastic ending to a show.
Okay.
And... All right. Let's be somewhat organized about this. I've tied myself in knots trying to get my thoughts straight about this type of topic. And I think we might end up going down a sort of a Golden Fleeces, MacGuffin type chat.
Mm.
Because it's splitting hairs and it's semantics, but there's like open-ended endings.
Yeah.
There's ironic endings. There's Pyrrhic victory endings.
Cliffhangers.
That's true, cliffhangers. And I'm not sure whether my pick is an ironic ending, open-ended ending, or an ambiguous ending, or whether they're all the same fucking thing. I don't know, you see.
Don't call me stupid.
So I'm hoping that you're going to help me out here. Anyway, the ending to Sopranos.
Yeah.
It's very good, but the creator of that, what's his name? David Chase. He came out afterwards and definitively said, this is what the ending means.
Okay.
And that's a shame.
Yeah.
Because I think that these types of endings... Yeah. They're ones which you debate on the way home from the cinema.
I agree. And you never want to get the answer from the filmmaker. This is one of the things that in any, because I was doing some research on the stuff.
Or the screenwriter, so stop giving us notes.
Any of these films that have very famous ambiguous endings in which the filmmaker or the screenwriter have come out and given their answers as to what is actually being said, it demystifies and takes away so much from the film for me, because a big part of the joy of ambiguous endings,
or if they do a sequel,
what's fun about ambiguous endings, giving the viewer a chance to play a role in the narrative.
Yeah, choose your own adventure ending.
Yeah, you decide what was being said, what your own interpretation of the story. It's the conversation after the film in which you continue to talk about it, and this is what's actually going on, and everyone having various interpretations of what the fuck the film was, filmmakers were trying to say. That's
the lost in translation whisper.
Yeah.
Your hair stinks.
Does it matter? Does anyone know? We don't want to know, do we?
He says, "Hail Hydra."
Hail Hydra. Very good.
But you know, when you're talking about like directors not being definitive or, you know, being definitive and telling you this is what it meant. It's like with David Fincher in Zodiac, when he basically solved who the Zodiac was. And it's
this was
done
on my
from
list.
Our Discord.
Yeah, it's done from our Discord. Right. Poor Don. Zodiac was on my list, right, for this topic, because I was like, oh, Christ, because it came up on a lot of lists. And then I went and watched it. The Zodiac is an amazing fucking film, and David Fincher has cornered the market on doing great serial killer stories between that and Mindhunter and Seven.
And Benjamin Button.
Yeah, of course. But when you actually watch the end of Zodiac, I don't think it's very ambiguous. I actually think he's pretty much nailing his,
flags to the mast.
Yeah, he's like saying, this is the dude. And it was never solved, but we're pretty sure this is the dude. But what I want to say about, I don't care whether it's an ambiguous ending or not. It's a fucking incredible ending. Because when Jake Gyllenhaal, the scene before the penultimate scene, we'll say, when Jake Gyllenhaal goes to the hardware store to look the prime suspect in the eyes, who he's had a cat and mouse kind of relationship with over the years, and locks eyes with the guy behind the counter, who is this lovely, soft, kind of like, but very, very tall man who
seems...
He wouldn't harm a fly. And they just look at each other, and he's the way his face changes. Oh my God, it was sent shivers right down my spine again. This might be my fifth time. Really brilliant stuff. Really, really powerful stuff.
Can I help you? No.
Yeah, it's good. It's funny that the scene where he goes to that guy's house who has a basement, and he tells him, to
Roger
step
Rabbit.
Into the basement. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
Roger
the guy
Rabbit.
who did the voice of Roger Rabbit. The tension, and it's like, well, hang on, I know what happens here, but still, you're caught under the spell of the film. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so listen, I am not 100% sure what counts as an ironic ending or a Pyrrhic victory or a cliffhanger or an ambiguous or an open-ended ending. Because for me, I think an awful lot of really, truly ambiguous endings, they're kind of unsatisfactory. It's like the story ends before you get a satisfying resolution, mm-hmm. and you don't have enough information to be able to decide what was that all about. I'll give you an example of a film that I was really on board with and enjoying. And then I didn't get it at the end, and I was okay with it. I was okay with it. Like being like, I'm glad when a film is weird, because it's like, it's not conventional and expected. And I'm not like going, okay, that's how you did it. Well done.
Yeah.
Versus like, I didn't expect that. But what happens then if I don't really have a handle on it, it doesn't mm-hmm. stay with me. It sort of just evaporates. It becomes this like dream that I had where you cannot remember your dreams. It's like, I experienced somebody else's dream, but I can't remember the details. It's hazy. And that film for me is Enemy.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I was, as you were saying this, I was like, I watched Enemy at the weekend, and I had the exact same experience.
I can see your notes, so I'm like reading from your notes.
I swear to fuck, Kevin. What's going on? We should start a podcast. We're so in sync.
It's gonna be bad.
The only Denis Villeneuve film I had that was on my watch list that I hadn't seen, obviously. And I said,
his name wrong there, Will.
What is it, Denis?
Dennis.
Dennis Villeneuve. And I said, I gotta watch this because it was on a lot of lists for best ambiguous ending.
Helen, did you plan on doing something tonight?
The film didn't stick the landing.
Because I think I have to go out.
When the credits appeared, I went, what? I said, hold on a second. Is there not a final act? Are we not going to go...
Helen?
Going to go an extra mile with this? Are you going to leave me with that image? Is that it? Just didn't work for me because I wasn't able to... Maybe it's because I'm a bit dumb.
A bit?
Yeah, I'm... Okay, a lot, right? There was obviously doppelgangers going on. There was some secret organization that was going on. There was a spider... crawling across a table. One of the doppelgangers was in on it. but it didn't culminate with any sort of resolution.
So why do you think films from David Lynch work when they're just entirely like oblique and open to multiple interpretations where you can read it several different ways and you're really just in his dreams, David Lynch's dreams?
Well, you've just said it. You've just said it. The difference with David Lynch's films is that David Lynch is one of the very, very few filmmakers out there who can create dreamlike films. He is the dream master. He's the person who can plunge you into his dreams. And the whole experience is about being kind of like moving through one of his waking dreams, essentially. And I think he plunges you into that experience and carries you through it and out the other end, whether you've got a narrative that's satisfying or not, or it doesn't make much of a difference. But he knows how to, what's the word, like a diver, a deep sea diver, bring you back up from that experience at the very end. You know what I mean? So yeah. It's like, it feels like a complete journey.
There's an emotional catharsis rather than a logical one.
There you go.
But then there's like, you know, we're talking about Jake Gyllenhaal. Donnie Darko is one where I remember, that's dream logic as well, but I remember people trying to figure out like what was the timeline that this was all happening, and I don't think you can figure it out. I think it's like, it's its own internal multiverse of concepts and ideas and things that interested Richard Kelly.
Yeah. It's a very, very mad
world. Films where you're debating what went on in the story. What do you think was going on? There's two that are juicy in that regard. For a long time, it wasn't really an ending, but it was like, well, maybe it was an ending. It was like Blade Runner, where you were wondering, is Deckard a replicant or isn't he a replicant?
I think it became an ambiguous ending with the director's cut, and now with subsequent cuts, he's really clarified that, no, Deckard's a replicant. He's put some shimmers in Deckard's eyes. So I think he's taken the ambiguity out of it in that instance. So I think that film is one of those films that kind of has had an ambiguous ending, and it's been shifted around as different iterations have happened. Does it add to the film? Yeah, I think it actually does.
He is definitely a replicant.
We are driven by wanting answers. We want answers all the time. That's what drove Lost, like where everyone was like digging in and trying to uncover, like, what does this mean? What does that mean? It drives us mad.
Yeah.
But to circle back to what I was saying about two genre films, that they sort of inspire a conversation about the film. What did you think it meant? What did this mean to you? And that would be Total Recall.
Oh, of course.
Is he dreaming or is this really happening? Did he really go to Mars, or was that all part of the holiday thing that was injected into his brain?
Yeah. And that final scene in Total Recall, where it's him and the rebel agent girlfriend that he is acquired, like, you know, that he's partnered up with throughout the story. It does start to, like, the way that the music score swells becomes very cinematic and romantic almost. And it feels like, hang on, this actually feels like a Hollywood ending. This feels like the end of an adventure, which kind of, I think you definitely could interpret it as, this is not real. This is not real. It's too Hollywood. It's too glowing. And it's also Paul Verhoeven who does shit like that.
He does. I tend to think that, I'll put in two versions. Yeah, I think that he was a replicant, but also I don't know whether he was or not dead.
Yeah,
he could have been a ghost all along. It's up for interpretation. But the other one was Inception. And I remember sitting in the audience watching Inception. And Inception is a film that I fucking loved in the cinema. It was like, whew, that was a movie. That was like proper blockbuster where I swept along. I didn't know where it was going to go. And it was like spectacle and big ideas. And it just felt dazzling. And I remember, maybe it's just me wanting the gratification of that crowd pleasing moment
closure
that he didn't give me, which is that the little totem that Leonardo DiCaprio's Cobb character has, it will definitively let us know whether he's still dreaming at the end or whether he's not. And Christopher Nolan has sort of laid it out where there is things that indicate that he is dreaming, there's things that indicate that he's not, that these are memories, and it can go one way or the other. But then he doesn't tell us definitively at the end because he doesn't let us see the spinning top fall over. He just lets us see it wobble. And I remember watching it and going like, oh God, that's such a like a prick tease of an ending. It's like, just give us that fucking release. Like, why are you now like not letting us like blow our load at the end? You want us now to just like walk out stiff as a board and cranky. And
I have this image of you in my head now, Kevin. Happy. Walking after this, a double dover.
You were supposed to delete those pictures, Will.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah, yeah. Listen, we all need leverage, you know? That's all I'm saying.
I now think that what he did was smart because it extended the conversation of the film.
Of course.
It's not this hermetically sealed story that the film bleeds out into the parking lot, into the car ride home.
And also, it also, in a way, can be a little bit cynical because it could generate extra ticket sales for people who want to go back and pull at the thread and figure out the answer to that puzzle.
I wonder if those two things are linked, where you pull the wool over somebody's eyes, but you want to pull at that thread.
Yes.
Unravel.
Yes, maybe they're all connected. But having my two cents on Inception, I genuinely kind of love that ending now. I love that idea that, hang on a second, there is a chance he's in a dream because there's a choice. He's a choice that he can potentially make right here. And it actually dovetails into another Leonardo DiCaprio film where a similar position was there. I don't think it's as successful as Inception, but Shutter Island, Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island.
Marshall, welcome to Shutter Island.
Your boys seem a little on edge.
Right now, we all are.
We take only the most dangerous, damaged patients.
This prisoner.
When did she escape?
It's as if she evaporated straight through the walls.
No one wants to talk about this place, but it's like they're scared or something. You're a random maze. You'll never leave this island.
This place is going to be the end of you.
It's a similar thing where it presents the situation where Leonardo DiCaprio is a detective going on to this. It's a kind of a hospital, mental institute type of island. But as the film goes on, it's revealed that he is actually a patient of this island. And the whole thing is like this elaborate recreation of the crime or, you know, what's had him there. But he asks the question.
We talked about it in Plot Twist, didn't we?
We probably did. Yeah, we probably did. But he asks a question, Leonardo DiCaprio's character asks a question that, would you rather live as a monster or die as a hero?
It's a great question.
Yeah. But it's implying an ambiguity as to what his character's state of mind is at the end of the film. Like, you know, is he consciously going down this road and choosing a path?
There are two films where I feel they took a decision at the end and I would have preferred them to have an ambiguous ending. Mm. And we talked about one of them, and I think it was on the time travel episode, Safety Not Guaranteed. Do you remember when I was telling you that I would have preferred if they did not tell us that they did not show us that he went back in time and they actually left it open to interpretation where Aubrey Plaza had found that time capsule. Mm. And it was like, did he go back or is that just more of his delusions? The other one is, did you ever see Take Shelter?
No, I have not. Yeah, I had one with Michael Shannon.
Yes.
And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So Michael Shannon believes that the apocalypse is coming, that it's like we all need to essentially take shelter. And you think that he's basically been pushed to the brink. Life pressure has gotten to him and he's had a breakdown and he is putting his family through hell, what have you. And at the very, very end, it's revealed that, you see, because a friend of mine suggested this as an ambiguous ending, but my memory of this ending was that it was unambiguous. We learned at the very, very end that he was right to have these illusions, that he wasn't a fantasist, that he was bang on the money and that it was the end of the world. Because the very last shot is like the encroaching tsunami or a storm that's like rushing towards them.
Wow.
But yeah, so it's an interesting thing because if you do an ambiguous ending right, it extends the life of the film. And I don't think I would have remembered the last shot to Inception if it wasn't that prick tease of an ending.
Yeah.
versus something like Take Shelter, which spells it out and says, no, actually, he wasn't delusional. You were wrong to doubt him as well. Look.
And in the case, do you prefer, do you think it made Take Shelter a better film for knowing that? Would you prefer it if you didn't have that definitive statement at the end of Take Shelter?
In the case of Take Shelter, I think it was lose-lose. Both endings would have felt unsatisfying to me.
Mm.
So I don't know. But in the case of Safety Not Guaranteed, the other version would definitely have felt more magical. I would have had to go back over everything in this film and think, hang on a second though, what do I want to believe? And is that sensible to think that?
And in the case of Inception, I think because the whole structure of the film is about being in these different layers of dreams, it's always in the audience's mind that they are on a dream plane. And so there's a chance, a part of the
unreliable narrator type thing.
Yeah. And there's, and also it's a part of the stakes of the story as well, that you can get lost on in different strata of this, of, you know, in this dream space. And so it's very much embedded in the audience's mind as a part of the story makeup. So the, you know, it doesn't feel like it comes out of the blue because you've been considering it the whole time. What happens, you know, if they get stuck in this, on in the office building? What happens if they get stuck in the James Bond level? You know, that sort of thing. So I think it's appropriate for that film and it works. Whereas you don't necessarily need the closure, I think, for that to feel satisfying. So it's interesting. It's case by case, really, isn't it?
Then there are films where if you were to ask people what their favourite ambiguous endings are, The Graduate would come up because right. of that very final shot mm-hmm. between the two of them on the back of the bus after he has basically gate crashed the wedding that's about to happen and she runs off with him. And they've had a very toxic sort of love affair.
Yeah.
And you have that fleeting moment of like, catharsis, where the two young lovers end up together and they're laughing and giggling, and then the realization of what they've done sets in. It's the opposite of most stories, which is that it doesn't end at the moment where you think it's going to end. It just continues on a little bit too long to where the magic is gone and the reality sets in, and it's like, oh, we got a peek behind the curtain, and you see on both their faces that they realize they've made a terrible mistake. But because it's what people would call an ambiguous ending, that has me then questioning, what about that is ambiguous to people? Because to me, it's telling you quite clearly that they feel like they got caught up in the emotion of everything, and now they have set off a bomb in their lives, and we're basically just seeing that hit home for them.
But
that's not ambiguous to me.
But it is ambiguous.
Definitive.
No, it is ambiguous in the sense that if that final shot was them, you know, nestling into each other's necks or whatever and smiling and, you know, happily, you know, whatever, that's closing off because you project the happy life. They're running away, you know, they're off into the sunset, everything's happy. But with that shot, it's ambiguous because you as an audience member, you're going, oh shit, what happens next? Like, what's going to happen to them? Is one of them going to get off the bus? Are they going to try and live together for a while? You know what I mean? So there's real ambiguity as to what the next step of their relationship is.
I guess it's just saying that it's not, that what you see in the movies is not reality. It's not a fairy tale ending.
Yeah.
And what is that saying that people use, which is that a happy ending is just an ending which ends too soon? That if you just keep going a little longer, every happy ending
goes to shit.
Ends. Yeah, because it does. Nobody gets out of this life unscathed.
Yeah,
it all ends the same way for everybody.
Of course.
So you just have to sort of sit with that. It's more challenging, but there's something quite beautiful about that.
Oh.
So I don't know. For me, it's like ambiguous, unambiguous. It's all about, do you appreciate the emotional sentiment that you're left with at the end of the story? Do you feel enriched by that ending?
Yeah.
Rather than frustrated by it.
Yeah. And quite often, it's a dangerous game to play because quite often you're risking frustrating your audience, making them annoyed and getting them cross and angry. But if it's pulled off correctly, you're pulling them in. You're going to pull them in and make them. If the film, I think, is unsettling at its core, if the film is kind of challenging you some of you some or planting in you some existential ideas, then hey, that's a part of life. You're going down. The thesis of the film is going down a route which is apt to have some sort of ambiguity, because it wants you to go away and reflect on them and quite possibly, you know, take some of the messages from the film and impart them in your own life and, you know, make you feel a little bit existential about your own existence.
Yeah, paranoid.
Paranoid, yeah, that's a good word.
I feel paranoid about everything. I'm always looking over my shoulder. And I'll tell you, because you're saying this, horror does it a lot.
The ambiguity. I always think that they're just crying out for trying to plant the opportunity for sequels. Where's Michael Myers?
Yeah, but that's
where did he go to? Where did he go to? Every Mike Halloween film.
Yeah,
where is he?
But the first one is that you're never really safe. That evil will always be out there, and that wherever evil looks, it sort of tarnishes everything. So it's the genius of that ending with John Carpenter's film is that he shows you all of these lovely little safe suburban environments that we've seen be infiltrated by Michael Myers. He's not there anymore, but suddenly nothing feels safe anymore. It all feels tarnished and creepy. It's like you would never want to really be alone in that house anymore because you remember what happened there.
Yeah. And
horror tends to work well with the open-ended ending of like, you didn't get the happy ending. Stay vigilant. And I'll tell you one that I was going to have as my pick based on this conversation, whether I could justify the one that I'm going to go with. And if I couldn't, then I was going to go with my alternative pick. And my alternative pick is It Follows, the ending to It Follows.
I've been meaning to see this film for years. I've been meaning to go on.
Fuck off. But no, but you don't even like films.
I do like films. And just with horror films, I'm a bit slower to get around to horror films. I don't mind you spoiling things for me because I assume it's going to have an ambiguous ending. So continue. Spoil away on It Follows.
At the end of the film, after the dance sequence has finished, and they're all like, you know, jumping around naked.
Okay.
And like juggling and stuff like that.
I was there going, okay, there's a dance sequence and now there's juggling. I'm still into, sounds like a typical horror film. Continue.
Yeah, it could be The Wicker Man. It could be Hereditary. Mm-hmm. No, obviously in It Follows, there is some sort of entity, some sort of curse, some sort of demon that will walk towards you.
Right.
And it can take on the visage of somebody close to you or just a stranger. It can be anybody, but they will keep coming towards you and only you can see them. And at the very, very end of the story, after we think that Micah Monroe has vanquished the demon that took on the visage of her own dad, her dead dad, it ends, she's got rid of the curse that was put upon her, which is that, you know, if somebody has it, they sleep with somebody else and it gets passed on to them.
Okay.
At the very, very, very end, she's walking down the street with the guy that has a crush on her, the two of them by themselves, and just off in the distance behind them, there is somebody walking very slowly behind them, and you don't know, is that the demon or is it just a random person? And, you know, you're left wondering. And I guess that's what a really good ambiguous ending is. It leaves you wondering.
Okay, yeah, of course. And it keeps you unsettled and shaken. And, you know, that it works so well in the horror genre. It's great. I have one ending that's not a horror film, but I think the ending kind of feels like a bit of a horror ending, right? It's Taxi Driver. The very final scene of Taxi Driver, and actually probably the final shot of Taxi Driver, you know, feels really ambiguous because to your point of what you said a minute ago,
I'm trying to remember it.
Okay.
The shootout at the very...
After the shootout, right? So we have the shootout where I have a whole theory about Taxi Driver. I go on a bit too long about Taxi Driver, but I think...
Take it away.
Okay, Taxi Driver, here we go. Will's writing theory class. I have this thing I go on about. I feel Taxi Driver is a brilliant subversion of the classic hero's journey in a lot of ways, in that Travis Bickle is a classic hero. And in the classic hero's journey story, you have a hero who gets a quest and is supported by a mentor or some wise person who helps them on their quest. And he finds allies to help him defeat the ultimate bad guy and save the damsel in distress. Well, Robert De Niro's character is Travis Bickle, who is a Vietnam vet who's come back to...
Is he, though?
Oh, yeah. Maybe he's not. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
But he comes, the archetype.
If he believes that, that's all that
exactly
really matters.
But this is the thing. Yeah, yeah. He's got a hero complex, or he's got this kind of quest that he wants to go to. He wants to save the damsel. He goes, and at various critical points in the story, he goes to his only mentor for advice. And the only mentor he has is this other lad played by Peter Boyle in The Taxi Rank. And his name is Wizard, right? At two or three critical moments in the film, he goes to Wizard and he says, Wizard, I'm at a fork in the road. What should I do? I've got to go on a date with Sybil Shepherd. What should I do? And he says, whatever, kid. Just take her to a movie, do something, blah, 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 blah. And just kind of fobs him off. And Travis Bickle doesn't really know exactly. He takes what he says kind of out of context, and he takes her to a porn movie, and it all goes to shit, and he fucks up. And then there's a moment later on when Travis Bickle is on this kind of vendetta to save Jodie Foster, who's a child prostitute on the streets, and save her. And before he goes and commits this act of violence, he goes again to Wizard, and Wizard just goes, fobs him off and says, fuck off, I've nothing to do, whatever, kid, just forget about it. And he gets no guidance whatsoever, and his mentor fails him essentially. So he's a hero without a quest. He's randomly searching for a quest, and it turns into this blood splattered scene of violence. But the very end of the film, at the end of it, you're talking about, you can have a perfectly closed ending, because the final scene is him in his taxi cab. And we're hearing the voiceover of the letters from Jodie Foster's parents. He is essentially the hero who's completed his quest. He saved a damsel in distress. And who gets in the back of his car? Only Sybil Shepherd, who totally rejected him earlier in the film. And Sybil Shepherd is kind of like, he says, oh my God, I recognize you. Oh my God, I read about you in the papers. Wow. And he's kind of smiling back at her yeah, I see. I'm not a jerk. I'm a bit of a hero. If you ended the movie right there, you've got a closed ending, wow, you're off into the sunset.
Crowd pleaser.
But it doesn't. She gets out of the cab and they kind of make an arrangement. Maybe we might see each other again. But as he's driving away, there's a moment where it's like the Elmer Bernstein score has this almost a psycho cue of sharp, discordant notes. And
yeah.
Travis Bickle looks in the mirror and even the frame kind of warps or something like that. And it's the sense, a really unnerving sense of something just went crosswired in his brain. And us as an audience, we're going, holy shit, the ending we thought we were getting isn't the ending. Things aren't right. Something's wrong here. And all I'm saying is, where's Taxi Driver 2? Where's Taxi Driver 2?
Queen Latifah, wasn't it? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
That is fascinating, though. That is fascinating, because I have never questioned it. There are certain filmmakers, and Martin Scorsese is one of them, where you just give yourself over. And what happens, happens, because you trust that they have a reason for everything. And I don't know, I think that film is like, it's holding up a dirty, grimy mirror at society and about those types of men. And and not everyone sort of sees that. Not everyone sort of sees what's being reflected back at them.
Mm-hmm.
They're just sort of they're taking it at surface level. It's like Scarface.
Fuck, yeah.
Scarface is a hero.
Yeah. You fucking show him, Taxi Driver. You fucking take it to the man.
Yeah, it's glorifying violence versus, showing you the bad guys that you can think are cool guys.
This is a very fractured, a person with a very fractured mentality. And they're in their own minds, they're the hero of their own story. Of course, like all villains are the heroes of their own stories, of course.
So what we're saying there through this episode is one of the great strengths of an ambiguous ending is you get to basically continue the conversation after the film. Mm. And I've never really talked about this with anybody else. Sometimes, I lament the fact that I grew up without any other film fans. Nobody else loved films like I did. So it was always very internalized for me. It was like I loved films and everybody else saw films, but I fucking loved them. So Barton Fink, I've never talked about the ending of Barton Fink with anybody.
Right,
do you remember it?
I have it on DVD and I remember loving it. And I remember John Goodman. Tell me about the final scene, because I remember the fire in the apartment, which was so epic, and John Goodman, and it was brilliant. Tell me about the final scene.
It ends on the beach, and this beautiful woman is walking up towards John Turturro, and he's got the briefcase with him, and she says something to him, and he can't hear her. He's like, what? And she goes, it's a beautiful day, isn't it? And he goes, yeah. And she goes, what's in your briefcase? And he's like, I don't know. She's like, isn't it yours? And he's like, I don't know. And he says to her, "You're very beautiful. Are you in pictures?" And she said, "Oh, be serious." Mm. And then she just holds this pose that's almost like a painting. He's gazing at her, at this like vision. And then a bird just dive bombs into the water and goes plunk. And ends. And it's like, what does that mean? But it obviously means an awful lot to John Turturro in that moment.
I you know what, that's one of those films that I have seen and I loved, but I haven't revisited it in about 20 years. And I have to go back.
Do you know what
I
think's in the case?
What? What do you think?
Gwyneth Paltrow's head.
Oh, God.
That's a terrible joke. Fuck it. Anyway.
Because we're on the Coenbrothers, they've done a load of ambiguous endings. We've mentioned one of the films loads of times, so I don't think we should bring it up. But just for box ticking thing, the end of No Country. Oh, you went, gone mute. Fuck you. Did you purposefully go mute? He's just miming now. The end of No Country for All Men.
No. I was miming a serious man because you were going to say No Country for All Men.
Yeah, No Country for All Men. And I only saw A Serious Man in the cinema, so I have to rewatch that one as well. Mm. So that one's got a brilliant ambiguous ending. I absolutely adore the ending for No Country for All Men. But we've definitely discussed it in the past. No question about it.
People always say the same thing.
I've got two films I want to mention. Both of my films are films that I saw in my teens when I was really getting into cinema. And one I definitely want to mention is the ending to Being There, the Hal Ashby film from 1979.
I'm Chance, the gardener.
The gardener?
Yes. Since I was a child, I've worked in this garden.
Then you really are a gardener?
Oh, yes.
You know, Chauncey, there's something about you. You don't play games with words to protect yourself.
And no brains at all. The stuff with rice pudding between the ears.
On television, Mr. President, you look much smaller.
Dumb as a jackass.
As long as the roots are not severed, all is well. And all will be well in the garden.
I don't think I've seen that.
It's got an ambiguous ending, and I want to. It's a very famous scene.
No spoilers.
Unfortunately, you're going to get a spoiler. I love this film. I think this film is actually a really wonderful film. It's based on a book by. Oh, he was a very famous writer.
Stephen King,
Jerzy Kosinski, right? So he was originally Polish, and he got out of Poland during before the war. So he was an immigrant in America, and he wrote this. And
Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret. Being there, and then are you there, God?
You know, The Painted Bird was one of his very famous books, and this was a famous book at the time. It was adapted by Hal Ashby, right? And it's the story. It's a comedy, but it's kind of one of these dark. Satirical comedy, so it's not ha-ha comedy. Stars Peter Sellers.
Typical Hal Ashby.
All you gotta be is white in America to get whatever you want.
Yeah, it's got satire at its core. It's Shirley MacLaine, and Peter Sellers plays this gardener in this old waspy estate house in New York, or Washington, I think it actually is. It's Washington. And he's basically lived there all his life, and he's mentally challenged. He obviously has learning difficulties, but he speaks perfectly fine and appropriate. And all he's done his entire life is worked in the garden, his house. When the owner passes away, he's left destitute. But what ends up happening is this innocent walks out into the street. He's clueless, absolutely clueless. But because he's dressed well, he's got tailored clothes, he speaks with a very proper accent. He ends up, whoever he meets, takes him at face value. As in, they look at how he's dressed, first of all, and think he's an important man. And he goes around, just talks about, he says, "Well, I'm just a gardener. My name is Chase. I'm a gardener." He says, "All I do is tend to the flowers in winter, and I help them grow in spring." And everyone thinks he's speaking a haikus, and he fails upwards into high society of Washington, right up to the president.
I have not seen this at all.
He's on TV. He ends up on TV and all that sort of stuff, and people are taking him like he's just very wise, thoughtful mind because he speaks in haikus. But the final shot in this film, and I'm going to spoil it for you right now, is a moment where he's at
shit.
The final, he's at the funeral of the, he's either at the funeral of the billionaire or the president, I can't quite remember which. But anyway, it doesn't matter because in the middle of this funeral out in the snow-covered park, Chauncey Gardner, or Chance Gardner, they call him Chauncey Gardner because everyone misunderstands what he's actually saying. He just gets up in the middle of the funeral, this very stately funeral, and sees something down on the water. And he just starts walking down through the trees, through the leaves, through the snow, just innocently looking at this beautiful plant close to the water's edge. And he straightens up this little tree that's growing there. And then he looks across the lake, a big lake right there in front of him. And he just starts walking out and he steps onto the lake and he keeps walking right across the lake without sinking.
And like film, Jesus? He like walks Jesus, on water?
He walks on water.
That feels like a punchline ending. It's, he walks on water.
The final shot is of him walking on water. And it really leaves you with...
What do you think that's saying? That's like, to me, if I'm interpreting it based on what you're saying, it's like to stop second-guessing yourself. You know, if you believe, if other people believe in you,
yeah,
then you can achieve anything.
This
and
is
you
very...
You don't need to run yourself down. And that if enough people believe you can do it, you can actually do it.
This is actually... what you're doing, I think you're hitting on it, Kevin. Without having seen the film, I think you're hitting on it. That ending wasn't in the original book. Hal Ashby added that ending, that final shot, to the film.
Life is a state of mind.
And in the film, there's a quote on the wall from Ayn Rand, and the quote is, life is a state of mind. And that ties in to what you're suggesting.
Yeah. What's ambiguous about that, though?
Well, I suppose it's making a commentary of, hang on a second, isn't it amazing that if you look right, it's completely surface. What he's saying is completely surface level. He's being quite literal that if you prune the plants back in winter, they'll grow strong in spring. But they interpret it as, you know, this is a message about our economy. This is what we need to do to get the economy going again. So it's all, this film is actually doing what we're doing in this episode of kind of going, hang on a second, if we leave the interpretation to the viewer, are they doing the job of the filmmaker and actually creating greater depth and greater meaning to their films? I don't know, Kevin. I'm a bit ambiguous myself about it.
In American Psycho, at the end, you don't know whether he's been imagining it all or whether he actually did kill them. Same thing, really.
Ah, yeah. At least kind of.
Hard pivot. No.
What about you?
That's interesting. Do you know what? That might not be a true ambiguous ending, but that is food for thought, because you've made me want to watch that film now and interpret it maybe in the way that they intended, or maybe just get something else out of it. Maybe it's just like, it's just a laugh, lads. It's just, you know, the world is full of idiots and you can pull one over them if you just don't give a shit. Maybe there's a cynical way to read that as well.
Absolutely.
Which is, they're just having fun on how dumb politicians are and how easy it is to convince people. And that's how idiots like Trump can become president.
Yeah. We project what we want someone to be, as much as we project what we want other people to see us.
No, but truly,
as we are.
Joking aside,
I'm not making any sense.
I don't think this is a topic where you can make sense, because it's all about being ambiguous.
Of course.
Yes.
That's our excuse.
What are we on about? Who knows? It's all up for interpretation.
People think I'm mad.
Yeah, yeah.
In American Psycho, you're dealing with an unreliable narrator, and the ending sort of undoes some of the things that you've seen. So you don't know, like, mm-hmm. Jared Leto, who he kills, is alive at the end. He sees him. Mm-hmm. It's almost like in Batman Rises, Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah.
Michael Caine. You know, we've seen him have a nervous breakdown in the film, and at the very end, you see him where he's completely lost it, and he is
hallucinating.
And he's hallucinating.
Yeah.
And he's looking around, he goes, there's Batman. And it's a beautiful ending.
I've seen people go to bat with that interpretation, that he's just imagining it. He's just imagining that Batman's there, Christian Bale's there.
Because it's bizarre. It's bizarre. Why would Christian Bale not react to him? But I think that's just his sort of, like, That's the ending he wishes that Bruce Wayne had got. He wishes...
Hold on. So do you believe, is your interpretation of that, that
Christian
Bale
Alfred is having a senior moment? Yes, that's my interpretation.
So you think that? I think it's not. I think he's seen him. I think...
Because why would Bruce Wayne not acknowledge Alfred? Why would he let him sit over on the fucking table by himself? Why can't he go over and say, Alfred, come over, for fuck's sake, join us.
Because he's not Bruce Wayne anymore. He's someone else. He's living
another
life.
That's very harsh. He's not living another life. He's Bruce Wayne. He's got to be able to say, fucking Al, come on. Jesus, how are you?
I have to say, I want to go back.
Who's he keeping up that pretense for? Like the other people in the restaurant? Garçon, turn your eyes. I want to say hello to you.
All I know, right, is how I felt after I left the cinema watching that film. And I felt that ending was tagged on, right? And it was deliberately ambiguous. Deliberately ambiguous to try and keep the franchise
ambivalent.
But I felt it was a cynical tag on because it was an attempt to try and keep. Hey, maybe he's still alive. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's dead. Maybe he's alive.
Okay.
I actually felt it was more of a cynical addition to the end of that story.
Whereas I would have kind of interpreted that as it's like, have your cake and eat it too. It's like, wouldn't this be nice? Here's the ending that would be nice to think about.
Yeah. But my point to Inception, going to my point in Inception. In Inception, I totally buy the ambiguous ending because the whole film has been about kind of like, well, what plane are we on? The Batman films aren't really about, hang on a second, are we on a different plane? Are we dealing with people's hallucinations or imaginations? You know, it's not established.
I'm joking when I'm saying that I think that Alfred is hallucinating. What I think is that it's a symbolic thing on the filmmaker's part, a flight of fancy for the audience, where it's like, he's being poetic. I think it's Christopher Nolan being poetic. It's not...
Oh, I know that you're joking.
He's not literally saying that Alfred is in a restaurant and he's ignoring Bruce Wayne and Bruce Wayne's ignoring him, because it's very alien. It's cold. It's very cold.
But so you are saying, but what you're saying is that the filmmakers are saying, oh, this is Alfred imagining that Bruce Wayne's across. It would be sitting in here that Bruce Wayne actually isn't there.
But isn't that everything with film? It's like what you're saying with being there. Isn't that ending a filmmaker's comment on the story that he's told? Where he hasn't walked on water, because that's going into magical realism territory. Has the whole film been magical realism?
I can't remember the ending of Dark Knight Rises that well. Do they cut back? Is there a cut back where Michael Caine, Bruce, whatever his name, Alfred, looks back at that table and it's
maybe
empty, but Bruce Wayne's not there? I'm curious because I can't exactly remember.
Maybe
like
you're right
there.
Maybe it's that we see Bruce Wayne first, but then that wouldn't make any fucking sense. No,
okay,
I think we see Alfred, and he's sipping tea by himself, and he looks over and he gives a beatific smile.
I'm going to just look at it, Kevin. I'm just going to look at it silently, right?
He stands up and says, "Sam, people, just want to watch the fucking world burn."
All I want to do is blow the bloody doors off.
Bruce stands up and goes, "Alfred, fucking hell, mate. Yes. I thought you were fucking dead."
Oh, hold on.
And Selina goes, "Don't call that fucker over. We'll be stabbed.
Hold on. I've just looked at it, Kevin. Just looked at it, right? So Alfred is at a restaurant, right? He's about to pay the bill. He's taking out his, like, you know, his...
He's taking out his iPhone and he's double-tapping.
Something catches his eye. He looks up. He looks across. We cut. He nods. Alfred nods.
Oi, oi.
We cut across. There's a matching eye line. He makes eye contact with Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne is looking back at him.
Hello, sweetness.
They're smiling. Mwah. There's eye contact. He's smiling. There's an acknowledgement.
You come here often.
And Bruce Wayne looks down. And Alfred kind of smiling, going, "I'll just let you to it, Master Bruce. Off you go."
"I won't keep you. I've got to pick up Robin from the hospital."
Master Bruce is there. He's not imagining it. Master Bruce is there.
Yeah, okay.
But I've seen people go to bat for your interpretation that it's like he's just imagining that Bruce is there.
I've only watched that film once because I thought that film was daft.
Why are we even arguing?
Fucking daft. All the police living down in the sewers for 18 months. None of them like needed to shave.
None of like them, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I know, yeah. And then they all come out and they're like, we'll have a fucking wrestle. Come on.
Wearing the same clothes.
I know, yeah.
It's all grand.
Where were they all shitting?
But it's interesting. I'm glad we were able to look at that, to revisit that one and actually kind of see what the fuck is going on there.
Well, I'll tell you my scene.
Oh, okay.
When you talk about like these open-ended endings, the ones that carry the conversation on after the film, this is one where the conversation has continued for 40 years and it will still pop up every so often, which is like, what happened next? Who was what? What was the setup there? What was the situation? What was going on? And it's a perfect film. I don't know if we've talked about it before on the podcast, but I'm hoping we haven't. We haven't talked about this ending. But for me, when I talk about like really satisfying and bleak endings and an ending where you're not 100% sure, but that ties into the themes of the story, which is this paranoia and this doubt that you have. It's the ending to The Thing.
I was going to bring it up earlier and I went, hold on a second. I was going to say it and I went, maybe Kevin's going to mention it. But we continue. We've discussed this in the past, but it is a brilliant
ending. Have we? Have we discussed this ending in the past?
Oh, you've talked about your theory for this one. On maybe it was when we did a commentary for The Thing, didn't we?
Gotcha, bitch. Oh, that's what it is. Yeah. Do you remember me used to do commentaries?
Oh, yes. I remember those nights. Late, late nights.
I don't know how we survived, but those were good.
Those were fun. People might not have heard your theory on the ending to The Thing, so get it out there.
Because I write, and because I have written, and I've talked about this before with you, I'm a bit more woo-woo about creating and about the creative process, because I've often sort of stumbled upon solutions to problems that I never ever would have logically thought about. They're divine intervention. Something has happened. The alchemy of thoughts and synapses firing and this leading to that and that leading to this. And some sort of like magical thing will reveal itself that feels like it always belonged there. But I never would have logically have thought of that. And I don't know where that comes from. And I think that that can happen with films where sometimes the filmmakers themselves are not the best people to analyze their own films. It's other people to basically tell them what they've created. So you can't really go to Ridley Scott and say, is he a replicant? Is he not a replicant? Because the film exists outside of Ridley Scott. Everything that we're seeing is just his creative impulses throughout a prolonged period of making art. And then the art takes on a life of itself. It's like when you're writing, a story will tell you what it wants to be. And you have to just get out of the way and just be the divinator of like choices and what have you. And also, if you don't capitalize on those moments, for me anyway, in the specific time when you feel that flush of creativity and that burst of inspiration, you can lose it forever. It will never come back. You can't logically think your way back to that place and recapture whatever that thought was. So therefore, when I watch something like The Thing, and I think of the creative choices that were made and the symmetry of the story, I feel like the film is telling me what the reality of the ending is, rather than what maybe John Carpenter thinks or what Dean Cundey thinks, because Dean Cundey had a whole thing of like he tried to light certain actors' eyes a certain way so that they'd have a glint, and that said they were human. If they didn't have that, they were not human. But because John Carpenter's, or because Kurt Russell's introduced playing chess, and he pours the drink into the thing and goes like a cheating bitch, and at the very end, knowing everything that he knows and knowing that swapping saliva or sharing drinks is going to leave you open to getting infected with the thing, he offers his drink to Charles and Charles takes it, and then MacReady, and you know it can be that at that stage it doesn't matter, so he doesn't care, but at that stage he chuckles. So I think that he thinks in that moment, oh, Charles is the thing. He's just got confirmation in that moment. So therefore, Charles is the thing. But the conversation has gone on for 40-odd years outside of that, where it's like, no. And then the people get really angry about it and be like, it doesn't fucking matter. It doesn't matter. But it's fun to think about, and it's fun to debate it, and it's fun to have a film where you can talk with other like-minded lovers of the film. What's your reading on it? Is MacReady the thing also? Is Deckard a replicant? Is Bruce Willis really dead at the end?
What? At the end of Die Hard, he's fucking dead?
Yeah, when Die Hard jumps off the thing, he's dead.
Fuck you for spoiling that for me. Oh my God.
So my pick is the very, very end. Is it ambiguous? Is it open-ended? I'm glad they've never made a thing too. I would hate to know what happened. I don't want to see old man MacReady with old man Chiles and going, do you remember when we got off Antarctica? Yeah, that was an experience.
Didn't they make a thing too? Or was it just a remake of the thing?
They made a sidequel called The Thing.
Oh, was that? Oh, right. Okay. So it didn't feature any of the characters.
No, just the dog from the first film.
If you're worried about me.
If we've got any surprises for each other, I don't think we're in much shape to do anything about it.
Well, what do we do?
Why don't we just wait here for a little while? See what happens.
I love that film. It was one of those films, one of those rare films that I watched, and once it finished, I just started it and watched it again. And it's really special. And it's one of those situations, again, where the ambiguity of the ending, that ambiguous aspect of it, suited that story because everyone
perfectly was
questioning.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're constantly questioning. You're constantly analyzing. Your brain's in that gear the whole. So it's satisfying for the film to end with the audience still questioning. That's the better way to end that type of story.
But I bet if you asked John Carpenter and he was, you know, 100% not giving a fucking, well, he's always like that. But in that moment, he just decided to just tell you and say to him, John, did you introduce Kurt Russell that way, playing chess with the drink? And then at the end, did that occur to you? I think he'd probably say, like, I didn't give a shit. I thought it was a good way to introduce him and it's a good ending. What the fuck does it matter?
Yeah.
But I believe that films become their own little soul. They have their own life.
Yeah.
And it's how you engage with it. It's also why when you go to the cinema and you see a film with different crowds, the film can play entirely differently. Film's exactly the same. But it's the energy of the audience that changes the film itself. Suddenly the film is not playing at the same speed or whatever. It's
something's off. There's a feeling in the room. And sometimes you could be, my God, that was the most amazing film ever. And then you watch it a couple of days later with a different crowd and it's like, it doesn't work. It just didn't work in that room for some reason. You're absolutely right. My ambiguous ending is the first true ambiguous film with that had an ambiguous ending that I saw as I remember growing up. It did all of the things that we said a film that it ends with an ambiguous ending should do, is it should carry the conversation on. So much so that I remember being in Leaving Cert or pre-leaving or whatever, and having a spare class. Remember these things called spare classes, or your teacher don't show up or something like that?
Yeah,
and
you've a got free class.
A free class, but you had a teacher sitting in at the front and you just had to fucking just sit with your books and read quietly or whatever it was.
Draw dicks on your copybook and stuff.
Yeah, that was it. I remember sitting at the back of a free class.
Can I just interject and just say to people, Leaving Cert would be, in the UK, it would be like your A-levels in the US, maybe your SATs. It's your final exam that you would sit when you are in school, before you go to college or university.
And
it's a big fucking stressful exam.
It's the most stressful exam you do I've ever done in my life. Ever. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Nothing more stressful.
Do you know what? Every single year goes by, I am grateful every year that I am not sitting my Leaving Cert.
Yeah.
I don't think that anyone outside of Ireland really understands how fucking pressurized and stressful it is. It's 2 years of studying for two and a half weeks of standardized testing where it's hours and hours and hours a day across multiple subjects. And my God, your entire future relies on the outcome of those tests.
And it's 7 or 8 subjects. And in some of these subjects, you have 2 tests, not just one. You have English paper one, English paper two, maths paper one, maths paper two, all this sort of shit. So it's it's grueling. It's really grueling.
So continue.
God bless anyone who has to face into it for coming to this time of the year. But there I was at the back of this free class. And I had watched the film on a Saturday night and it was just in my head. Sean O'Keefe hadn't seen it. So he said, well, what was the film like? And it's 2001, right? A Space Odyssey. And I'm sitting down and I begin to tell Sean O'Keefe the entire beats of the story of the film.
Oh my God, why didn't I think
and
of that?
I get to the final act of 2001 and I stop and I say, this doesn't make any fucking sense, but it was absolutely amazing. The moment where Cur Delay's character, Bowman, goes into the obelisk, the final monolith that's parked outside Jupiter, goes into this warp, whatever, has an experience with himself in this weird cold chalet where he gets older and older and older. And the film finally ends with this giant baby, you know, just orbiting Earth. And it is operatic, it is epic, and it is...
It's life. It's the cosmos. Exists within the creation of life, the conception of life.
Utterly amazing. Utterly amazing. And bewildered me. Bewildered me for years, but made me go back and watch the film over and over again. And really, when I got to the final sequence, I was trying to interpret what I saw was happening on the screen. And it was fitting for that film because starts you off with the Dawn of Man, jump cuts. It's trusting that the audience will take the leap across eons to, you know, man being going from, like, you know, fucking apes with bones learning how to use them as tools to man harnessing space power and rocket power and being out at space to, and now it's trusting us to take the next leap in that evolutionary phase into whatever happens next. And the ambiguity of the ending is utterly beautiful. Now, I love that scene. I love that scene.
Can I say, though, as you're saying all that?
Yeah.
The apes could never understand the future that we get to see, that we can imagine because it's our near future. So I think it's taking another leap, which is that humanity as it stands in the time period of Cur Delay's character in that 60s space era could never really understand the next leap that it takes, because we're just the same as the apes that are seen in the very beginning, that leap, indicating that that's where we are. We're just primitive. We can never really understand.
But you want to know something? To a point that we also made earlier on, when the ending is coldly explained by the filmmaker, it completely demystifies the illusion. Because in early 1980s, a Japanese film program rang Stanley Kubrick on the phone.
Hello?
And it's on YouTube.
I'm looking for you.
And the shot is like...
Can you talk now? Do you have a moment?
Of your mam standing in the hallway with a telephone to her ear. And it's this Japanese lad just standing there facing askew from the camera with the phone to his ear. And he says...
Hello, Mr. Kubrick.
How do you do?
How do you do, sir? My name is Jim Yaoi.
How do you do?
Can I ask you some questions?
Yes, of course.
Please. Well, Japanese people love your films, especially... Space Travel 2001.
Yeah. I've tried to avoid doing this ever since the picture came out, because when you just say the ideas, they sound foolish, whereas if they're dramatized, one feels it. But I'll try. I mean, the idea was supposed to be that he is taken in by godlike entities, creatures of pure energy and intelligence with no shape or form. And they put him in what I suppose you could describe as a human zoo, and to study him. And he spends his whole life passes from that point on in that room, and he has no sense of time. It just seems to happen as it does in the film. And they choose this room, which is a very inaccurate replica of French architecture, deliberately so inaccurate, because, you know, one was suggesting that they had some idea of try to give them what we think is their natural, environment. And anyway, when they get finished with him, as happens in so many myths of all cultures in the world, he is transformed into some kind of super being and sent back to Earth. Transformed and made into some sort of Superman, and we have to only guess what happens when he goes back. It is the pattern of a great deal of mythology, and that was what we were trying to suggest.
That's shit.
Yeah.
He was better off not to have told us that.
But that's my point. That's exactly the point. That sometimes you're better to let it in the interpretation in the hands of the viewers than to actually go and explain it, because if you go and explain it, it's kind of shit.
Don't explain your endings. Don't tell us anything. And we're in an age where everybody wants to know what everything means. And these YouTube channels that are just like, here's all the Easter eggs, here's all the references, here's what this means. And everything is a callback to something else. And it all just feels, everything gets smaller. Just let things expand and be bigger and weirder and don't explain them.
Yeah, I agree 100%. But listen, I'm going to do a Men in Black and wipe that from my mind. And I'm just going to go back to me kind of going, I wonder what it actually means. I wonder what the end of 2001 actually means. But anyway, it's a great ending.
Yeah.
Kevin, we did it.
We did. And you know what, Will?
What?
I'm going to be ambiguous about our next topic.
Ooh, okay.
I'm not going to explain it to you, but it's one that I picked. We got some write-ins by people, and I want to do one that we didn't get to do a while back when we gave people the option.
Yeah.
And it was at the live show. And I think we spun the wheel, I think, at the live show, and a topic came up.
Right.
And we asked the audience, do you want us to do this one? And they all went like, no. And I was like, oh, okay. And we did whatever the next one was. And now I'm thinking, fuck them, I want to do it.
What is it?
So the next topic, I'm not telling you, I'm going to leave it ambiguous. If you want to know what it is, go on to our website.
Oh.
And you'll see the next episode's cover art.
How do I get onto our...
Not yet, Will, because we haven't even edited this episode.
How do I get onto our website? So it's www.bestbitspodcast.com.
Right. And if you want to write in and give us some scene suggestions for future episodes, you can go to www.bestbitspodcast.com/contact and just tell us why you'd like us to do a certain topic, and we'd love that. But this is my way of just providing a little bit of engagement. We're not spinning the wheel. We're not letting the audience pick. I'm picking a topic that I want to do next week, and I'm not telling you what it is. There.
Very
I'll
good.
I'll leave you guessing.
I'll very, leave very
you
good.
Guessing.
And hey, come over and join our patrons. We have great patrons. This show is 100% supported by patrons. Thank you, our patrons.
We'll include a clip at the very end.
Wow.
Do you know what? I had this... Well, we should wrap it up. But I did have... No, I'm not going to say it. I'm going to leave it ambiguous.
Leave it ambiguous.
Listen, thanks a million for listening to us.
Yes.
Will, it was great to get on mic again.
Brilliant.
Looking forward to the next episode.
Yeah, as always, can't wait to get on mic again very soon. All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Oh, I forgot to talk about Whitney Illinois.
Ah.
Don't call me stupid.
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin. All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider becoming a Patreon member, where you'll receive bonus shows where we talk about recent releases and what we're up to.
And you'll receive access to our Discord chat room, where we hang out with our listeners.
Search the Best Bits podcast on Patreon or click on the link in the show notes.
And here is a clip from the lad's latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Mini Bits.
Another new episode.
Talk a deal, stupid cunts.
Patreon podcast.
Of this Patreon podcast. Exclusive.
Exclusive.
The Best Bits podcast with Will and Ken. Bonus content for you. This is for you, not for them, just for you. The Best Bits podcast with Will and Kevin. Exclusive content. You're on the talking films and shows. The Best Bits.
Kevin, how are you?
Hi, honey. How are you?
Oh, you know, I've got this. I've got my corns sorted out. I went to the chiropodist the other day, and she
your
said,
"Corn,
my corns. Did you ever get corns?
No.
Did you know what a corn is?
Yeah, it's a bunion on your foot, isn't it?
Yeah, like in between your toes, stuff like that.
Do you not wear any shoes like around the house? You walk
no,
barefoot.
No, it's the opposite.
GA shorts.
It's the opposite. I wear incredibly tight shoes, like those Chinese women.
Oh.
Who get their feet bound, who had their feet bound, like, you know, before the turn of this last century. And so they had incredible corns and bunions. This is a great opener for a Mini Bits episode where we get people disgusted.
Squally, it's episode 73 of the Mini Bits. I'm Kevin, you're Will. This is our Patreon podcast. Thank you to all our lovely patrons. Yeah. A few of you have jumped in recently. I don't know what we said. We try to goad people into joining up every single episode, and then every so often it's like a lot of people join because of one specific episode. And I'm like, how did we say on that episode that's different to the other 270 episodes?
Maybe it didn't sound as desperate. Maybe we said, don't join. Maybe reverse psychology. That's how we should do it. Reverse psychology. Don't join up to our patron. Don't.
Cancel. Everybody cancel.
You don't deserve to be in this group. We don't want you. We don't like the look of you.
We don't need anybody.
It's just us. It's absolutely just us. Hey, should we tell you? We did, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't say it on mic, especially so early. We did an interview with the Irish Examiner last Friday.
We did.
Yeah.
And
how do you think I did?
I think you did all right. Like, you didn't interrupt me once, so I was delighted with how I came across. But, you know, there's no sort of time limit on this. We don't know when it's going to get posted. One of our friends was saying, Kathy at the cinema was saying that their interview with, did they do the Examiner as well? It was 6 months before it posted.
And the Guardian, I'm pretty sure. They were profiled in the Guardian as well.
Yeah, but we don't do any really promotion. Like, we don't do anything.
Well, this is our first time getting any sort of like proper coverage, which is going to be mad. So listen to all you listeners who have found us before we explode. You're an OG. You're an OG listener before Kevin starts getting gold chains from all his Patreon dash.
I think I'm more of a silver than a gold. I think my undertones suit more silver. But
I just want to die.
Those are my Prince Albert.
Your hat?
Yeah.
I want one of those diamond studs in my tooth. That's all I want. So I can go bing whenever I'm on a call.
Oh, yeah.
Bing.
I usually just, you know, wink and that glints.
Yeah.
Like a starlight twinkle.
Speaking of which, I interrupted you. What did you want to speak of? Which?
Start the timer.
Oh! I forgot.
You may as well.
Start the timer.
All these lucky losers are listening in and they're wondering, what are we going to be talking about? But we have to start talking about them after.
Yeah.
We say goodbye. But look, I wanted to talk to you about, you've seen a few things. You've seen the new Godzilla film.
Yes.
I've seen the first Omen. I saw Scoop as well.
We're looking Netflix forward to watching this. We already see. Okay.
Okay. I'll save my thoughts. And what else did I see? I made notes, but sure, it doesn't really matter.
I think I saw it.
And I was going to go through all the summer releases and see what takes your fancy.
Okay. I'm looking forward because I don't actually know what's on the horizon. So
the Joker 2 trailer came out today.
I saw it. Yes, I watched that.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of Chicago.
Yeah, it's kind of like you see it's all very much in the mind's eye. They're calling it a jukebox musical. Am I right in saying that?
I think you're right in saying that.
So, look, hey, listen, what it did remind me of was that I want to rewatch The Joker because I saw it in the cinema and I thought it was fine. It was kind of a bold new direction.
I'm just going to go back and watch the episodes from the Batman 66 show, the Joker episodes.
Oh, yeah, that's going
to
be...
Just to fill me in, like, on the lore, you know, get up to speed.
Get you right up to speed. And you'll be there going, where are all the guys in the purple suits with the masks? When are they going to show up? And like,
it's a bit of a weird time though, where we have the Penguin TV show with Colin Farrell coming out, which is a totally different canon version of the Penguin Then you have this offshoot of Joker, which is its own universe entirely.
Mm.
And then you have the old Batman films that you can watch.
Right.
And, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's just, I don't know. I'm kind There's of so many IP.
But like,
it's just everywhere.
What's happened is the world, the comic book world has very much entered the film world. It's where you could have different runs, totally different runs of a character by it's different insane. Authors. And there'd be totally different riffs on it and stuff. Oh, this is insane. The thing. Kevin, so I'm only catching up on this. You mentioned it to me on a podcast. Was it on one of those show?
It was the last mini bits.
You said everyone's describing stuff as insane recently.
And have you started noticing it though?
Only with people trying to rise you. That's the only place where I've noticed people on Discord are trying to rise you.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I could start posting now, like tweets, comments, TikToks, articles, anything. Insane is everywhere. This is insane. That's insane. It's insane. There was a festival just going on about this insane lineup. Okay. I was like, oh, it's a mentally ill lineup. Okay. it's everywhere. And the other thing that's also bothering me lately?
Wow.
And this has been bothering me for years and years and years. It used to be that everyone used to misspell definitely. They'd go defiantly.
Okay.
Oh, it's defiantly whatever. It would just, there are morons. But no. I just keep noticing everyone keeps spelling a lot as one word, A-L-O-T, a lot. Where have they gotten into their heads that a lot is one word? It's the same way that people will write every time as one word.
What's the one that you've pulled me up on a few times and I can't get it right? Compliment.
Compliment.
I can't, but I can't get it right. It's like the
I. Because I told you the other day.
Yeah, and I went searching for it and I couldn't find it because I had to use it.
If there's an I in compliment, it's I'm paying you a compliment.
That's a good way to remember it. Okay, good. And then compliment.
I wrote that to you.
But you did, and I went to try and find it because I found myself writing the word compliment. And I went, shit, Kevin.
But you gave me a thumbs up, which meant in my world that, yeah, I read that. Thanks.
But I did, right? I'm talking about a couple of days later when I was faced with the exact same hurdle of writing the word compliment. I went, okay, what did Kevin say again about compliment? There's an I and the E. What did he say? So I went searching for it and I found it, I think. And I went, oh, the I is paying me a compliment or I'm giving you
it's
a compliment.
It's insane how little you can retain information. It's insane.
Come here, let's start talking about what we watched. Come on.
Did you start the timer?
Yeah, it's gone. It's ticking. It's ticking down. The world's going to explode.
You know, I have to put in the sound effect. I have to line up all my sound effects.
When you said start the timer,
I have a whole soundboard. Okay. Jesus Christ, where's my fucking
what?
Where's my ding dang ding?
Here we go. The timer has started. There we go.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Right.